Welcome to the Nordic Mythology Podcast. I'm Daniel Farrand, owner of the company Horns of Odin. And today I'm once again joined by Simon Nygaard. Every week I struggle with this.
Close enough, Dan.
I know. I feel like every time I have a guest on, it's just like, fuck, I have to figure out how to say this name. And I embarrass myself weekly. And then I apologize for it. And then everybody messages me saying, you know, don't give yourself such a hard time. And it's like, yeah, I feel like it's one of those things that kind of stresses me out, because I find it's like a respect thing to try and get it right. But there is just some noises that Scandinavian names seem to have in them that my mouth doesn't do.
Yeah, and I apologize for that on behalf of my country and on behalf of my language, basically.
I apologize for the Yorkshire mouth and our dialect, because we're very abrupt with everything. You know, anybody who's listened to me talk for long enough now, just, you know, we miss letters out, we're lazy, we just kind of very blunt sounding.
That's close enough to Danish, then. We tend to swallow the last half of every other word, so.
Okay, yeah, we just cut them off, especially T's. We're awful with T's. We just kind of forget. They're not even there. H's. And I'm from a town called Huddersfield, but we just say Huddersfield because we're lazy.
That is.
It's one of those things. Okay, Simon, do you want to just give a little introduction to who you are if people haven't listened to the first episode?
Yes, I am an historian of religion working at Aarhus University. Also, occasionally I visit Uppsala University as a visiting researcher there. And at the moment, I'm working on a research project on runic poetry and its performance kind of dimension from various angles, one of them looking at how an understanding of ritual can kind of help us understand what function, that's what I'm really interested in, what function runic poetry had in the Viking Age.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
That's an overview. That's, oh, you forgot, yes, also Matthias's evil twin.
I'm the evil twin of Matthias. Yeah, yes. I don't know how I, you know, became the evil one, but I don't mind.
Yeah, no. How did that happen? Maybe we just added that bit in there.
Yeah, probably.
I feel like everything needs like an evil side.
Yes. Yes. I'm happy to be back. Yeah.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, I'm glad to have you back. If I sound hoarse, is a little different to usual, that's because I'm a tad little bit hungover because I went to a gig last night, and you know what happens.
Yeah, that's how it is. Rock on, man.
Yeah, that's it. You're singing along, you're talking a lot,
you need to keep if you sing along, then you need to keep your mouth moist. Is that the word?
It is the word. It's not one of my favorite words, though.
No, that's why I kind of hesitated, because it does have a ring to it.
Mm-hmm. It's the correct word. It's just an icky word, I think. I don't know. It's just a bit like, ooh.
But anyway.
So I was a metal gig. And we said, was it in the last episode or before you are in a metal band?
Yeah, another passion that me and Matthias share is for black metal. Mm-hmm. And I'm in a black metal band, which of course is always relevant to mention to anyone who wants to listen or has to. But mm-hmm. for this episode, it's even more relevant, because we actually, I use my research in kind of building up the lyrical universe of this band, and use some of the runic inscriptions that I work with as inspiration, and as, you know, direct lyrics. The translations of the runic inscriptions function as a large part of the lyrics for the band, which is huge fun, a great way of kind of a fun way for me at least to get my some of my knowledge out there.
So do you, what language do you sing? Are you the singer in the band? What is what's your
I sing
role?
And I play drums.
Nice.
And we're called Wulfas. And which is, of course, the proto-Nordic word for wolf found on some of the runic inscriptions from Blekinge, Steintoften stone, for instance. Mm-hmm. We sing mostly in Danish, or I do. Occasionally also in kind of old Danish, reciting some of the rune stones, the runic inscriptions there, yeah.
So is it, do you just Danish rune finds, or do you go wider and
until now we've kept to Denmark.
Okay.
Yes, yeah, we have. Yeah.
Is it how metal are the runic inscriptions?
Not are they, very
no.
Well, a few of them are pretty metal, like the ones with curses on them, for instance, that, you know,
mm-hmm.
anyone who drags this stone away or raises it in memory of another one is and then a very what we presume is a term for someone, which is not a very polite term, but we don't really mm-hmm. know what to translate it with. It's called reti. Some people mean think it's like a warlock or something, okay. But it's a derogative term of some form. And then of course one of my favorite inscriptions is the piece of a human skull inscribed with runes found in Ribe, the Ribe skull fragment, which is just as an object pretty metal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's. You should have led with that one. That's a metal one.
Yes.
What does the skull say?
It says Ulver and Odin and Hætir. Then it gets a bit tricky. Several possible translations because, you know, runes are difficult to work with because mm-hmm. either they're difficult to read or rooting inscriptions tend to not do double letters. And yeah. In the Viking Age, you go from 24 runes in the Iron Age to 16 runes. Mm-hmm. So every rune can basically stand for 2 to 3 sounds, which makes it even more complicated to read. So it's, you know, I know that you like things that are complicated and that's the reading of runes. It's complicated. So depending on how you read it and which reading you prefer, the three gods or three names, one of which we're pretty sure is a god, Odin, and then help is carried against this dwarf and dwarfess, and then the name Bor. So the meaning of it all is probably that the dwarves are like personified disease. We see like dwarves and elves in later medieval folklore and later folklore and giants as well are creatures that or beings that can be the cause of disease, and that's what we think that this is. So it invokes some gods to get help or to help someone get rid of some form of disease, probably pain of some sort. It's been proposed that since it's a skull fragment, it's probably some form of headache.
Okay, so
yeah,
And is it carved on the inside or the outside of the skull? Because I originally assumed this was just a piece of skull from somebody that had died, and now I'm wondering whether it was carved in whilst they were still alive.
It's captivating and very alluring, but that's not that's sadly not the case. It's written on the on the inside of the skull, which is, no, sorry, maybe on the outside. No, sorry, it's on the outside. Yeah, it's on the outside of the skull and it's perforated from the inside. But all this has happened post-mortem.
Okay.
Yeah. And it, I think there's indications that the skull fragment is significantly older. Well, not maybe not significantly, but older than the inscription itself. But basically, okay. if that reading holds, then it's just a you know, Viking Age Ribes form of aspirin, right?
Mm-hmm. Wow. So do you think you'd give that to somebody with a headache, or how, can you speculate on how that would even work?
So the fact that it's been perforated or with this hole, it's made people think that it was an amulet to be carried, to be worn. But it was inspected by a very skilled curator who looked at it in a microscope and said, well, there is no wear in the hole, so there's no indications that it's been worn on a string, for instance. And it was found, because that would have been pretty cool and also would have made sense, right? But it was found on a mitten. I don't know what the preposition is there. Among garbage. So it's also possible that once it had been inscribed by whoever wrote the runes, probably on behalf of someone else, it was discarded. As we, for instance, we know that lead amulets that we often find in early medieval times, they have to be folded. So in order for the charm to work, or the curse, the magical piece of inscription, you have to hide away the inscription. Really? And that would make sense in you know, if you have a thing that you need to, you know, a piece of human skull that you need to get rid of, then you can just throw it on a mitten and it's, you know, out of existence until 1400 years later. And that would be kind of the concealment that you would need for the magic to work, basically.
Wow. So it would be a single use. Is that with most items like that? Would they be just a single use item?
That's the assumption. Yeah. We have magical inscriptions on little sticks, for instance, similar to the ones found in the medieval Bruggen inscriptions from Bergen in Norway, small rune sticks. We have bones, and we have lead used pretty often, and then one. At least one on parchment, in a manuscript. That was probably written down kind of as an instruction for someone. So you can do mm-hmm. this if you need to get rid of blood vessel pus. Also,
yes,
yeah, yeah. But the fun things, one of the fun, you know, getting into runic poetry is that this, or at least part of the Ribes skull fragment, is actually metrical. So it's part of the runic poetry corpus.
Okay, before we go on to the runic poetry, I wanted to ask, do you find when you're performing in the band and you're performing, I guess, you know, runic inscriptions that clearly have or held some power, maybe still do hold some power. Do you find that comes through in the performance? Does it become ritualistic in any way? Because obviously that is also what you specialize in.
Mm, yeah, definitely. I think we briefly talked about that last time. And I'm not entirely sure that, well, I'm not a particularly religious person, but I don't have that kind of firsthand experience of a religious experience like that, kind of a consuming personality altering transformational religious experience. But maybe that is what comes closest, I guess. But I'm not sure that the content of what I perform has much to do with it, for me at least. I think that, of course, it helps me create a more, I don't know, believable, not to me, but maybe to others, authentic kind of experience.
Okay.
Because the kind of the concept of the band works as a whole, but it isn't. I wouldn't say that I have a ritual. Well, a ritual, yes, but that's because I see ritual as a very broad thing, but not a religious experience per se.
Hmm. Oh, yeah, I was just wondering, because obviously, I guess most famously would be Hai Lung, who would call all their performances like a ritual experience, and that is that's how they perform. They open and close the ritual before they perform. And I wondered if you had any, I guess, similar feelings with how you with your performances, or whether it was just more.
No, we're kind of we go for a more kind of a more punky, in your face attitude.
Okay.
And feel it. It's the form of black metal that we play is quite crust punk inspired.
Okay.
So it's more kind of aggression, but joyful aggression.
Okay. Yeah.
That's a kind of the punky kind of in your face. I'm having fun, and if you're not, then that's your own fucking fault.
okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm in. I'm sold.
Oh, good.
So, do you just use modern Danish translations, or do you use like?
Yes, mostly. That's what I've been doing. Mostly. Some of the newer songs I'm trying out. Having at least part of the lyrics in old Danish, as kind of just because it fit. And that's the thing. I normally I just try and adapt parts of the Runic inscriptions to the music, and this time I was working with this runic inscription from the Randul stone, which is also partly poetry, partly metrical. And when we wrote this song, I tried it out to see if it fit, and it did. And it was cool. Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah, it'd be. Yeah, I imagine it would be fun to try. I know Matthias has done some little bits of helping people with lyrics in. I don't know whether it's he uses Old Norse or Old Danish or what.
I think he's almost reconstructed Indo-European or something like that, right? Proto-Germanic. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, which seems very fun. I don't know whether how close to modern Danish is old Danish. Would the average person be able to understand any of it or not?
Bits and pieces in writing, but it's closer to Old Norse, and thus closer to modern Icelandic than it is to modern Danish, basically.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Okay, let's talk runic poetry. That's what we're here for.
Well, we already have touched on some of the inscriptions that mm-hmm. are part of the runic poetry corpus. So basically, runic inscriptions existed, can be dated to basically from the turn from year one until they were used regularly until the medieval period, and a very, very tiny amount of them, around 200, are in some way metrical. And that means,
what metrical was.
Runic poetry is kind of the catchphrase. That's what makes it sound cool, right? But the more kind of used scholarly term is metrical runic inscriptions, because you know then you don't have to define what even is a poem. What is poetry? This and that thing. But meter, we can work with that. Metrical inscriptions, metrical runic inscriptions, are pieces of runic writing that conform to the metric requirements of the kind of the Germanic world and later of the Old Norse world. So they use some of the same meters as Eddic and Skaldic poetry. Mm-hmm. So the minimum requirement that we were, in the medieval tradition, the written Old Norse poetry, proper poetry is only present when you have at least half a stanza. And that's, you know, for Fornyðislag, which is one of the main Eddic meters, you have to have a minimum of four long lines. And a long line is a single long line is enough to define, at least in some scholars' opinion, enough to define a runic inscription as metrical. And the Germanic long line, which is kind of the base unit, the metrical unit, is has been proposed by a German scholar in the 1890s, as consisting of various feet, kind of metrical units that conform to some they follow kind of the same form, and one metrical unit is half a long line, and you have to connect them, and they're connected by alliteration, right? So the beginning of words, the words which carry stress, mm-hmm. that's what that they have the same letter, right? So for instance, from one runic inscription, a stone from Aarhus, it has the metrical bit Saad or Manna Mester Unedinge. So it has Manna and Mest as kind of the two words that connect the two bits into a long line. So Saad or Manna Mest Unedinge. That's kind of that's a long line. If you have one, then your runic inscription is metrical. And this means he died the most. You know the word needing, right? It's a very derogative term in the Old Norse world. If you call someone that without it being true, then you could be outlawed, right? And it covers kind of on. We don't have time to discuss the implications of the word "needing," but it's basically a very, very bad thing to call another person. It has connotations of bestiality and unacceptable behavior for the person which it's connected to. So if you're a man, then you're, for instance, accused of having had sex with a horse, or having been the passive part in a homosexual relationship. And that's behavior that's connected with that. So this is kind of one of the being a Unidinger is pretty much the one of the best things that you could be, right? So the least unvillainous, I think, is the English translation that's used sometimes.
Okay, so it's saying you're the anti
that. Yes, he died the best of men, basically. One of he died the best of men.
Wow.
Yeah, okay. And that part is kind of set in poetry, basically, on the stone.
So I'm still kind of, I guess I'm struggling to work out or maybe understand, how do we know the difference between just a sentence and like a piece of poem? Like what?
Yeah, I know that's very, very good. That's a fantastic question, then, putting me on the spot like that, because that's basically the discussion is, you know, some people are almost of the opinion that metrical runic inscriptions are not a thing, because so much of the language that's used on runestones is rhythmic and has alliterations in it. So kind of, this is the formula for raising a stone, stein and sati in Old Danish, for instance, are both words with S. And the presence of those two words in a runic inscription doesn't make it metrical. It makes it alliterative, but the metric only factors in when specific patterns of stress stresses and drops are present. So if you have a stress and a drop, and then a separation, like a pause, and then a stress and a drop, then you have a metrical unit of the A type. And if you then combine that with a sentence that has a drop and a stress and a drop and a stress, which is a B type metrical unit, then you have a long line. And it's only when that pattern, when you can analyze the inscription and find that pattern, that you have a metrical inscription. And it's very difficult to understand for us modern Shakespeare-infested people, because in our minds, poetry rhymes at the end, and you know that's it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it follows. It follows kind of a Greek da dun 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 da dun, or the opposite da dun da dun da dun da dun da dun. Dun, 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 dun. And then, you know, that kind of rhythm, that's what we can kind of identify as poetry in our kind of Western culture. That's poetry to us. And then spice it up with a bit of end rhyme. But that wasn't poetry in the Old Norse world. Poetry was different, right? It followed different culturally specific rules. And these were built up around the principle of the Germanic long line, which is this combination of metrical units into larger metrical units, who then can be combined into even bigger metrical units. Then we then get these stanzas that we have in Old Norse poetry.
So do you have to look at each one individually? So there isn't like a one size fit all formula that works every time. Do you have to kind of analyze every one and look at it and then decide based on?
Yes, ideally that's the way to go about it. So there are five types of verse, A B C, D, and E, and then several subtypes, and they can be combined in, you know, not an unlimited, because there are five and then the subtypes, so there are limits, but in very many ways. They can be combined in very many ways. And luckily, scholars have been looking at these inscriptions for a very long time and have kind of said, well, this is rhythmically formed, perhaps. Mm. And then we kind of, so we have a pretty good idea of how, of which runic inscriptions that we can analyze and see if they are metrical.
Mm-hmm. Does it help with translation or understanding if you kind of see the pattern in the line as a whole, and maybe there's a word that you're unsure of? Would it help knowing that it's meant, it kind of is part of this thing that has the rhythm, so you could kind of hazard a guess one way or the other on the word that's maybe in question?
Nah, not really. I can't think of an example. Yeah. So, well, I you know, not to say that there isn't one, but I just can't think of one off the top of my head.
Fair enough. Yeah, I just wondered whether it could kind of just help if there was something missing and you had this idea of a pattern that was maybe meant to be there, and he was like, maybe it's this.
The thing is that one case where you can kind of perhaps use it is when you have a runic inscription that's damaged, and you can parts of the words or parts of the words that are legible, they form words that you can recognize from other stones. And if is then part of a metrical inscription, then it's a good chance that the metrical part forms the metrical part perhaps is structured around an oral formula. So for instance, the Unidinger inscription that I mentioned, he died the most unvillainous of men. That's present on stone 5 from Aarhus, but it's also present on two runestones from Sweden, from Rørbro and Skabbe. No, that's the buckle. Some other place in Småland. So they're almost follow the exact same formula, and that's kind of how oral poetry works and works, basically, that you have this. You have this kind of back, you have this stock of expressions that you can use writing poetry that follow these metrical patterns. Some of it does, at least.
So, would things like this be similar to, because with you just saying then that little phrase is found in, mm-hmm. in Denmark and in Sweden, which means obviously it's a popular saying, I guess, just how we have popular sayings today. Is it a common thing that they would write on? Because I guess a lot of runestones were used as, were they not gravestones, but like an honor to somebody who had died? Yeah, memorial. Yeah. So is that something we see commonly on?
Yeah. So runestones, for the most part, and these are kind of the big stones that were raised, most of them are just memorial stones. They follow the same pattern. They have this person raised this stone for this person who was a fantastic person, the first part that's basically it. This person or these persons raised this stone for this guy or gal, and then there are also a limited amount of variation that you can then end it with. Some just have that bit, some even just have a name. Some of the older ones. You can then vary with an obituary of some form. You can as well, he died the most unvillainous of men. That would be a very suitable obituary. And then you could have a prayer there because, you know, the majority of runestones, at least in Sweden, are Christian. So they're often they often have an invocation of God or Christ or the Virgin Mary or Saint Michael or something like that. And then you could finish it all off with who wrote the stone. And that's basically what, I don't have a percentage, but most of runestones from the Viking Age, at least, follow that formula or a variation. And what's commonly in research on runic poetry, that research puts the runic poetry primarily in the obituary category. So it's part of the function of runic poetry is to add a little extra spice to your runestone. So it's it adds a higher form of praise to the one to the person who's memorized on the stone, and it does so in a way that makes it different from the majority of other runestones. And that's kind of that's what a lot of the research into runic poetry and its function. That's kind of where they've ended. And I think that's correct, of course, for many runestones. I think there's more to it, and it doesn't explain. It doesn't explain the, for instance, the one we talked about in the beginning, the Ribe skull fragment, and a lot of the inscriptions that are metric but also magical in some form.
Yeah, because when I think of poetry, particularly from the Viking Age, I obviously go to skaldic poetry, and then I'm thinking of the maybe one of the reasons it's a poem is for performance sake, because it's, you know, it's made to be performed and entertaining and possibly even to remember it. So then when you said they were it's on the written stones, I was a little bit confused as to why they would bother making it into a poem if it was just there to be read, because I assume it wouldn't be performed. It's just
that's kind of that's another aspect that I'm looking at is the possibility that these inscriptions were used by people after they were raised. So it's commonly kind of accepted or that when you raise a runestone, you just don't, you know, it has to be ceremonial, and so it has to have been ceremonial in some way. You just don't dig a hole and put a big ass rock there, and then that's it. You go home, have your tea. That's not how it worked. Well, that's not how we think it works, because we don't have any descriptions of people raising tombstones, sadly. But there have we assume that there have there was some form of ceremonial or ritual actions, basically, and the placement of runestones in the landscape that makes runologists think that they were they had functions as kind of border stones, but also power display. So if you had enough resources to have a runestone made, then you were powerful, and that was a way of showing that. And they were often raised besides roads, ways of transportation, by bridges, near waterways.
So they're intended to be seen.
Oh yes, very much so. Yeah, they are.
So I guess I may be falling into the trap of comparing it to modern things, whereas with we put a gravestone up usually where somebody's buried, because that and is that the same thing, or does it not really matter where the body is? It's just that this is a memorial, and that's why you would then put it by a road so people would see it.
Exactly. There are very, very, very few runestones that we can comfortably connect with contemporary burials. It was a very common assumption in older research that they were burial monuments, basically, and they were always. Well, initially, people thought that they were buried with people, and some runestones are, but not all. They were assumed to have been standing on top of a burial mound, and some are, but not very many. So the connection with burial is not perhaps the primary connection that we should assume. But I think that there's still something to be said for at least a monumentalized connection. So runestones are, we have a lot of examples of runestones that are part of, for instance, the ship setting. So a stone setting, two rows of stones that are formed like a ship. So ship formed stone settings, and in one end sometimes you see runestones raised as kind of the prow of the ship, and you want to know more about that.
No, I feel like I visited one of those places. It's like somewhere on the border between Norway and Sweden. I can't remember the name of the place. It was like a giant ship made out of standing rocks.
Yeah. Yes, and they come in various sizes. Of course, in Denmark, we have the largest that's ever been found in Jelling. Yes, over 360 meters long.
Wow.
Well, we don't have it all, because farmers in the 1800s they didn't care about monuments, so they just took them and built houses of them. But we have some. I could talk on and on about the Jelling monument site, but basically one theory is that the small Jelling stone that's gone the old road for his Queen Thirdby, that the theory is that it could have been standing in the one end of this huge stone setting, but we don't really know, because someone built a huge bragging mound in the end of that. Well, Harald Blåtand, Harald Blåtoft, he built a huge mound just to show off. There's no one buried in the mound, it's just giant.
It feels like runestones are just a giant flex now. I it's just like this I assume, because even though we have a lot of runestones, I assume that you had to be wealthy and of importance to be able to have one of these erected. Now it just feels almost kind of like a little bit of a dick move as well. You know, you can just imagine driving down the motorway and then there's just a big billboard of some rich guy who passed away, and it's like, he was a really cool guy. He did, you know, he was the best. And it's just like, why is it there?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, it kind of continues in into the Middle Ages with kind of plaques and stuff like that in churches, that you can pay a shitload of money to have someone make a inscribed tablet that you can hang in your local church to commemorate how cool you were and how good your family were and still are. And that's kind of at least some of the function of the runestone is to show power. But also, you know, the Viking Age culture was vastly different from modern culture. Mm-hmm. And kind of showing respect in that way was a huge deal, and honoring honoring the dead, and thereby honoring yourself if you were a relative. You know, your honor was closely connected to that of the entire family, and raising a runestone was both honoring the dead, but it was also mm-hmm. something that you did to your own acclaim.
Mm-hmm. I feel like it's the putting it next to the road or the waterway or where, I don't know, I feel like that's just kind of like a big flex on like, look what we can do, look, we're going to put it right here so you have to see it. It's not like, you know, we're going to put it somewhere that they loved, you know, like people have benches made for somebody who's passed away and it's like mm-hmm. a memorial bench and it's usually somewhere that they found picturesque or enjoyed to go and you can kind of go yeah. and pay respect, but this is like, no, we're just gonna put it right where you have to look at it.
Yeah, that's a huge part of it, a large part of it. Sometimes it's combined, right? So for instance, with the Randbull stone that I talked about earlier, that I used this for the lyrics for one of the songs in the band. That's one of the only stones, at least from Denmark, that we can connect to a contemporary burial. It was raised on top of a grave, on top of a grave mound that was excavated in 1875 or something. So it was, you know, done by the standards of that time. But there was a skeleton found underneath the stone. And it was a skeleton of a person that was no more than 30 years, probably female. But the only reason we think, well, that the archaeologists thought that it was probably female is because on the stone, a female was commemorated. So the inscription has a man, Tofi, raise a stone in memory of his wife, who's called Thorgunnr, and that's basically the it's an interesting inscription, but the metrical part is probably the most interesting, at least to me, and that's the last part of the inscription, which reads Þær staffa mono Thorgunni mjög lengi lífa. So it's these runes, these staves will live a very long life for Thorgunnr. And that's just a very kind of, I really think that's a pretty, pretty cool little piece of verse to have written for your deceased wife. Like, you know, I'm putting these runes so that your life can continue, you know, way beyond the lifespan of anyone. Basically, mm-hmm. and you know, we have the stone still today standing. We can read it, we can visit it, and kind of make that. It's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah,
we're still commemorating Thorgunnr, looking at that runestone now. Mm-hmm. I think that's lovely.
What's the phrase? A man dies twice: once when he dies, and once when somebody mutters his name for the last time, something along those lines. Yeah, and it's that kind of idea, isn't it? That it is. We're sat here in 2023 talking about the stone, so he's done his job.
Yeah. Exactly. Raised in sometime in the late 900s, early 11th century, well over 1,000 years after, it still does its thing. And kind of the fact that it's on top of a burial mound that we can, I would say, pretty comfortably connect with the inscription, that's pretty unique. And then the placement of it is pretty much a couple of hundred meters from the most used road north-south in Jylland, in Denmark, from the Iron Age and until modern times, the Oxen Road, and that's it's placed, you know, right there on top of a mound. Look at me. Yeah.
I take it back. I don't think it's a dick move anymore. That's quite sweet.
I think it is too. So that's kind of this idea basically, that maybe I wouldn't defend the notion that we are still kind of performing the unbroken memory of Thorgon when we talk about this runestone, because I think there has been a discontinuity of culture, and so the memory of her hasn't lived for 1,000 years. But I think the idea that people would have kept that kind of memory alive, either, you know, by getting it recited every now and then, because we, you know, the who could read runes, we don't really know, but we assume that at least up until the late Viking Age, it was pretty few people. It was limited. And then in the Viking Age, in the late Viking Age, it starts to become common, we think, for traders to use runic inscriptions and to use runic writing. But up until that, it was probably kind of a more narrow group of people, a more narrow elite that were able to read runes and to write runes. So it wasn't, you know, if you passed a monument with a runic inscription on it, you couldn't necessarily read it. But you know, maybe someone you knew could read it. Maybe you knew what it said, even though you couldn't read it. We don't really know. But that kind of interaction with the runic inscription in contemporary times, I think that's highly likely, and I think that's very interesting, especially for an inscription like this, which you know it needs to be read, right? It needs to be interacted with in order to kind of fulfill its function.
That's got me thinking, which could be dangerous. I don't know. Do you think that? Because it sounds like, I'm going to put two questions together here. It sounds like the metrical part, like if a runestone has like a runic poem, it doesn't have to be the whole thing. It could be just part of it. It doesn't have to be, yeah, it's not the whole thing. It could be the most important part, like with the one that you were just telling us about. Yeah. So then do you think that maybe they've used that, like poem style, is because most people can't read it, so maybe it could be read by somebody and then remembered easier and then told and kind of would be passed on through in the same way, I guess, the, you know, Scottish poems would use the poems to remember things easier so they can perform it again. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I think part of it is like that. Even, you know, the runic inscriptions in themselves are not complex texts, right? The content of them, which as we just talked about, is pretty limited. If you know, if you know 10 runic inscriptions, you know 1,000, basically. Okay. It just the names just change almost. And that, you know, that's very simplified, but it's not because, you know, understanding them is not the necessarily the difficult part. So I'm not sure that it holds 100%, but the metrical parts of the runic inscriptions that are metric are often very central to the inscription, and that's for the ones that are completely metrical, which aren't very many. That could probably be you know, flexing again, because look at me, I can write an entire inscription in. As a poem, but for the ones that were part of it's only metrical, it's often at least for the ones that I've looked at up until now, quite central bits of the inscription. And so I think that they kind of strengthen that memorizability. That is probably not an English word. It should be.
I mean, I know what you mean, so we can just pretend exactly it is.
That. So the I think what you're getting at, partly at least, is that it's easier to remember something that you can put into a meter. You can it's easier to remember a poem than it is.
And
to
then I guess easier to then be passed on to the majority of people who can't just read it. So it's kind of one of those things where you have something and maybe you don't understand it, but everybody knows what it says because you just do. You say you get told as a kid to like, oh, that over there is for so and so. You just kind of know it. You never have to go and read it. And plenty of memorials are like that. I think most people in their little town or village will have a memorial to somebody or something. And you just most people probably don't even have never gone up and read the little plaque. It's there, but you just kind of you know from being told.
Exactly. And that's so there's this theory about memory and how people and how groups remember things and keep in remembrance. And that's what you described there would be a memory place, right? So a place that in itself holds a and has a function as keeping a memory alive. And that's part of the function of many runestones, that they maintain this collective identity of the group of people who are associated with it. You know, at the very least, the family, but the wider kind of village, for instance, as that's kind of similar to what you describe here, that they may not have known exactly who was memorized or who was commemorated, on the runestone, but they know that there was someone important and that it's there and that's what it does, right? Mm-hmm. So runestones are also these memory places, and they... memory places can shape and uphold a collective identity for a group of people. So they're part of they can kind of keep their collective memory, their collective identity coherent in some way. And that's also very much what some of these runestones do.
Mm-hmm. Do we know how the process behind how these were made? And I guess to expand on that, you said if you read 10, you pretty much know what they all say. And is that because the stone carver would have let's to simplify it would have like a little book of or an idea of like these are. Yeah, like these are the things that we put on here that commemorate, and it's a nice way to say it, and we can have it as a metric. And he's got like a little catalog almost of things. Or do you think you would have somebody in the area who would create it for you? Because it's a skill as well. I can't write a poem, not one that I want to put on an expensive runestone.
And that's really interesting because actually part of the project is also to look at the rune carver and what it means for the rune carver to be able to compose poetry in addition to the fact that this person can also read and write runes.
That's what I was wondering, whether it was one person or maybe it was two people. One was the poet, one was the carver.
So one theory is that the reason why much runic poetry is what some scholars call bad, because the metrics aren't completely on, and you know it has like irregularities, is because it's kind of like songs that you write, the song that you write for your nan's 75th birthday, right? You try your best, but you know, you're not Shakespeare. It's you have other qualities, but you can still make a song that people can sing to whatever festive melody that you choose. And that's kind of that's one idea, is that it's the same with these metric parts of the runic inscription. Inscriptions, is that they form kind of a tradition of commemorative verse written by people who don't do poetry normally. Okay. That's one idea. And that can be perfectly true. But I still think that it means that this, you know, the way that poetry is constructed in the Old Norse world, the kind of the metrical requirements would still be something that you would have to be familiar with, in order to be able to write poetry, even bad poetry. And I think that's important, because of course there's no way to know whether the person who carved the runes was the same who composed the inscription and composed the verse, but it would make sense that it was part of the rune carver's toolbox, you know, to be able to do it.
I love trying to put this stuff into like a modern context, or where my brain goes anyway. And they're going to be thinking of you get, let's say, a couple are getting married and the groom wants to write and sing a song, but he's not a singer or a songwriter, but it's a sweet thing to do. So he does it anyway. And sometimes they nail it and it's absolutely amazing. But sometimes, I mean, for everyone that is amazing and goes viral on TikTok, I'm sure there are tons that go terribly, terribly wrong. But it's kind of sweet doing it themselves rather than outsourcing. But also, they're not singer-songwriters. And I feel like it might be a similar kind of thing. Like, it's nice to do it yourself, but if you're not a poet, you're just not a poet.
But do you think
it would have value to them doing it themselves?
Well, I think that the how rune carvers worked in the Viking Age, at least, is that they were professionals. They were, so in Denmark, for instance, we have a group of stones, three stones raised by or carved by the same rune carver. Two of them are raised by the same woman called Ragnhildr, who raised the two stones for her two dead husbands, basically. So she was a powerful woman who had powerful husbands in two different places in Denmark, and both stones. So the runes are similar. And the composition of the stones also similar, and they both carry this curse that I talked about in the very beginning, that if you raise this stone for anyone else, or you remove it, then horrible things will happen to you. And that guy is mentioned on one of the stones. He's called Soti, and he was presumably associated with that woman and her kind of family. So we have in slightly very late Viking Age in Uppland in Sweden, a guy called Öpir, who was a rune carver and who carved tons of rune stones. In the small university park in front of Uppsala University, there are, I can't remember how many stones, but there are maybe 15 or 20 stones that have been collected from all over Uppland and raised in the university park. And he's written a lot of them. He's carved a lot of them, this guy called Popier. And so it was professionalized. It was something that's, of course, not a full-time profession, because not much else than being a ruler or a farmer was in the Viking Age. But it was something that he did as a job. It was a skill, like being a smith or being a leather worker or whatever. And with, you know, as with, for instance, smithing in the Viking Age, being able to transform things into other things was very highly regarded. And it was something that carried ritual connotations. Recently talked to Terry Gunnell, professor in Iceland University. I think has he been on the show?
Yes.
There's a fantastic guy. And he said that, well, try to imagine that you're a Viking Age warrior. You prefer the spear. You have a fantastic spear, but you have a problem because you always lose it in battle, because when you throw it, you know, it's very hard to find again, or at least it has the potential of going missing. Mm-hmm. But if you then get someone to inscribe your name on the spear, you can find it again.
So it's like when your mum put your name in the back of your school jumper.
Right. But only this is in an oral culture where you've never seen writing before, or you've only heard tell of it. And now you have runes on your spear. We have inscribed spears, so that's why I'm giving you that example, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like a magic recalling charm, right? You can go onto the battlefield if you didn't die. And then you can find your particular favorite spear again, because on the spear, your name is written.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, some of the earliest runic inscriptions that we have are on personal objects, weapons and combs and boxes and stuff like that. And you know, part of at least for the weapons is that, you know, that's fucking magic. Being able to find something in a heap of other similar weapons, you know, you can find your spear again. And of course, it isn't the only identifying marker, right? You can have artwork on it. You can, you know, remember how it looked. But having runes written on it was something special, right? And that being
could,
able to
could they? That... Oh, sorry.
No, sorry.
No, I was going to say, would they be able to read their own name? Like, is it? Because I imagine it would be unlikely they could actually read it. So, in which case, it's kind of irrelevant that it says their name, but it's also but that kind of makes it a little bit more magical as well, because it's
No, think of the trust you place. You know, if you like modern examples, modern parallels, the trust you place in the tattoo artist who tattoos Chinese writing on your arm.
Mm-hmm. Right?
You read it? Nah. But you trust that he didn't write Kung Pao Chicken.
So many did.
Strong tiger or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, but so many have fallen foul to that. But that's probably the same with... It must be the same with runes in modern time as well, because you see so many people asking for translations of runes on different Facebook groups, and there must be tons.
I get those emails as well.
Oh, you must. And there must be you must be tempted sometimes to just send something silly back. But
I have a small measure of integrity that can try and
uphold. I know. you couldn't. Even if it was
I did actually, you know, I in my son's school there was they had a Viking Age themed week where I was very tempted to just remind the teachers that if they had Viking Age, a Viking Age theme, and the kids were going to write their names with runes. It was a good idea to use, you know, the younger Futhark, the Viking Age rune role, and not the older Futhark, because that would, you know, not be correct. But I didn't, because I didn't want to be that guy. And I regret it, because of course they used the Elder Futhark, and I'm not sure that maybe one of a handful of people in the entire school who knows that it's not correct that my son came home Runestone, where his name was written in older Futhark. I regret that I didn't say, even though it is more difficult because there aren't as many runes and you have to compromise. E and I are the same, and U and V also the same. K and G also the same, but you can that just makes it more fun, right? Be creative. Mm-hmm. But I didn't, and that's how it is. I did give them a small talk to the first graders about Old Norse mythology, and
oh, nice.
That was a lot of fun. But I didn't play the professor with the raised finger saying, "Did you know that actually?"
I imagine you were the cool teacher.
Well, I think I am.
Yeah. Yeah, you've got tattoos and a beard and stretchers, and you're in a metal band. My teachers were like that.
Nah, yeah, I try to avoid the tweet university lecturer. Look, not that there's anything wrong with that, but it's not for everyone.
No, it's not. It's not. It's refreshing to see. Otherwise, so to go back to a question that I had before.
Yes,
and I touched on it briefly, and I just wanted to kind of expand or maybe even clarify what I meant. Mm-hmm. Do you think that the carver, there would ever be interference from the person raising the stone, in a sense that if these are mainly done by wealthy people, there, I guess there would be some reasonable. It would be reasonable to maybe think that they could read and write in runes.
Yes.
So is it possible that they would then interfere with and kind of like, this is what I want. I want it to say this, and they would give a phrase or a little metric sentence or a couple of sentences, and then the person would have to carve it? Or do you think it would be pretty much all down to the rune carver?
Well, in the end, it would be down to the rune carver, but you know, if you don't do what the customer asks you to do, then maybe you don't get customers in the future, right? Mm-hmm. That's at least how it works nowadays, right? In some professions, at least. But of course, if the sponsors of the runestones could read runes, then they would of course have a say in it, and some could also raise runestones themselves. This guy Soti, for instance, he raised a runestone for his brother, and we also have examples of fantastic a Swedish runestone from Firby in Sweden, which is basically a block of cliff just lying in a woodland area, and it's inscribed with runes, and it says that the two brothers, who by the way were the most the rinastar men av Midgardi, the most rune knowledgeable men in Midgard, the first mention of that word, coincidentally, raised this runestone, or not raised, made these staves, because they didn't raise the stone. It was just in there. They wrote the runes on it. So they made this inscription in memory of their father. So that's an example of the sponsors and the carvers being the same person.
Mm-hmm. So would they call them? Oh, sorry, you finish.
Stop.
No, would they call them runes then? Because you said on two inscriptions they referred to them as staves. Is that how they would refer to the runes?
I think so. Now, you know, we talked about my emotional support books in the beginning, and mm-hmm. I have one of my emotional support books with me in such a case because I can't remember, but I can find out for you here, Thorstein. No, that's not the one.
We did joke before as well how you never have to grab your books, and I was like, I'm going to come up with a question where you have to look in the book.
And now I did, and it was they do call them staves. And one other interesting thing about this stone, which is also metrical, right? Of course, it is that it is all of the runic inscription is metrical, and it uses the first person. So the stone or the inscription is the one who's talking. So it says that I know that Haustein and Holmstein, the brothers, the most rune knowledgeable men in Midgard, they placed this stone and these many runes after their father Freystein. So it's a pretty cool inscription. It's one of the only we have like maybe 15 tops, 13, 14, 15 examples of complete stanzas of poetry and runic inscriptions. And fewer that are just kind of metrical all the way through. But it's really interesting, this one, because it talks. Talks to you. Has agents.
So are there, do we find rune poetry on other items? It seems like, I'm guessing the vast majority is on runestones, but you mentioned before the little skull fragment is
exactly
metrical. So how many other items do we have?
So we have mainly runestones, but then we have these bone fragments, for instance. We have the Ribe skull fragment. We have a rib bone from Sigtuna, which is also inscribed with a metrical inscription. We have pieces of wood. We don't have very many because the preservation conditions have to be pretty good in order for them to survive. So we have one which is a fantastic inscription from Schleswig, from in northern Germany, which is about 10 centimeters long and 1 by 1 centimeter little stick that's inscribed on all four sides with a poem, a rune poem, a stanza in Ljóðahátt, one of the other main Eddic meters. And it's very hotly debated, well, as hotly as anything can be debated within academia. Whether this is a curse or a charm or, you know, just a joke, because it's the inscription mentions that this wealthy or powerful young man carved runes on this piece of wood. And then it says that the Aesir in the days of yore. And then has a part of the inscription that doesn't make sense. It's just weird words. Hullar og bullar, hullar og bullar, which is kind of in Scandinavian language we have, or at least in Danish we have huldar til bulldog, which is kind of a way to describe a mess. Like it's everything is just laying in the huldar til bulldog, like a big old mess. But this is maybe either an onomatopoeic word, like it describes a sound that's intended to be, you know, produced by the inscription, or it's a what we called a voces magici, a just a like abracadabra, a nonsensical phrase that has magic described to it. And then the last bit of the inscription is may your ass speak as your stomach.
Okay.
And yes, and that's why people are like, okay, this has to be a joke. Like this has to be a parody of kind of high flung Eddic mythological poetry, because it's right around the year 1000, so it's kind of in the end of the Viking age and beginning of Christian early medieval Christian period, and that's kind of, so people think maybe, okay, it's a joke, it's someone taking the piss, composing a poem about farts or something like that, invoking the gods and then talking about farts. Maybe
if it was actually a really serious,
I guess that's the thing, because that's the other possibility. One of the other possibilities is that this is a diarrhea curse, right? I bring upon you a very serious case of diarrhea.
And which I guess, you know, is laughable today, but it was probably very serious at the time.
Yeah. If you could die from that. Dehydration is a real problem. So that's one. But the meaning of that last phrase, meli thua sumagi, is not entirely clear. May your ass speak for you as your stomach. But what does that mean?
Yeah, I can't even guess as to what it means.
No, when your stomach speaks, it rumbles, right? Mm-hmm. And bubbles even maybe. So that's the farting in interpretation. That's you may have a serious bout of farting. So you know, you don't really know, but yeah, that is very odd. And that's written on stone. That's not written on stone. That's written on wood. And then we also have lead as a common material as well. Lead and copper and other forms of metal. We have, for instance, a copper amulet from Sigtuna in Sweden, which invokes the god Thor to conquer a giant to cure wound fever, so some form of fever caused by blood poisoning or something like that. And then it goes on to have the last part, the one that's the kind of the first part of it, the first, it's two-sided. The A side is the one that calls out the giant as the cause of this disease and invokes Thor to cure it. And then it gets weird. It speaks about three desires and mentions someone either called Ulver or which is wolf, or yeah, it's weird. It's something about nine steeds as well. And yeah, it's a weird inscription, which is possibly metrical as well.
Mm-hmm. So it So it seems, I don't know, I get the feeling that when something has high importance, then it becomes metrical, or they try and use that form to give something some sort of gravitas, I guess. Is that accurate?
At least many of these inscribed objects that aren't stone tend to have what I call a crisis function. So it either inflicts a crisis onto someone or it averts a crisis for someone. Okay. So these healing charms, for instance, are kind of apotropaic, horrible word, mm-hmm. magic charms. Like magic charms that prevent something from happening or better the situation in some way. And we have curses, which also are a form of crisis. They inflict the crisis upon someone. For instance, the possibility that this the Schleswig runestick is a curse for someone to fart eternally or have a violent case of diarrhea. Mm-hmm. But it could also be a cure for someone who's very constipated. So it has both options there, as we talked about. And a lot of these inscribed objects that are metrical seem to fulfill that function. But again, you know, they are a very tiny portion of the runic inscriptions as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Okay, let's wrap this up. Is there anything you feel we need to know? Anything we've missed? Anything blatantly obvious?
No, I don't think we could have probably talked a bit more about ritual, but we spent all last time doing that. Mm-hmm. But of course, needless to say, these magic, the curses and the healing charms are a form of ritual. And I think that carving the runes and composing a runic inscription is a ritual act in some way, not necessarily religious, because as I see ritual as a form of a category that encompasses both religious and non-religious acts. So mm-hmm. carving and raising a runestone is a form of ritual act. But I also think that composing the poem, composing the metrical part, adds a layer to that. It adds another layer of ritualized behavior. And in the very least, in the sense that in as performed texts, which we talked about, like as recited texts, the recitation is a form of ritual. And a recitation of a text that mentions a deity or another form of otherworldly being claims knowledge of another world, right? And in that mm-hmm. sense, we can see it as a form of sacral text, a form of text that has a place in the religion of the people who used them. So these last inscriptions that we talked about, the crisis ones, all these magic charms and curses, they invoke names of gods or otherworldly beings, and so they are kind of texts that have a place in a very kind of a very real lived part of religion in the Viking Age, mm-hmm. and that's something that I'm pretty excited about having, you know, getting to work with on a daily basis.
Yeah, wonderful, wonderful. I mean, Simon, you're welcome back anytime as well. We can go into depth of everything that you're ever working on. I always enjoy talking to you.
That's good. I enjoy talking to you as well, Dan. And I hope that none in the crowds are cursed with eternal farts, or that alternatively, if some of you are constipated, then you know,
maybe
you're welcome.
Yeah, hopefully you reading it out, and then thousands of people listening to it isn't going to.
I should have probably have read it aloud in Old Norse. That would have maximized the
yeah.
But I take no chances.
By, we should have, yeah, by law,
signed a waiver of responsibility before locking on. Then,
by law of averages, there's going to be one person listening to this who does get diarrhea around this time of listening to this, and they're going to be like, "Oh shit!"
I apologize. I take that on my shoulders.
Well, not figuratively, not literally.
Yes, of course. Well, as father of a 2.5-year-old, you know, also. Literally.
Absolutely. Okay, if you enjoy the show, please leave us a 5-star rating and a positive review wherever you get your podcast. Also, if you can pop over to our Patreon, it's Nordic Mythology Podcast on Patreon. That's patreon.com/ Nordic Mythology Podcast. Jonas is now back in Europe, so we're gonna start back up with the story time episodes, but there is a whole back catalog on there that you can listen to as well. And yeah, just follow us on Nordic Mythology Podcast on all the platforms. Simon, where can people follow you?
If
you want them to.
Well, you can follow me on Instagram. I think Dan and the team have linked to my Instagram account in the post for this episode, and also on Twitter. I'm on Twitter at no hair, don't care, and hair is the furry creature with long ears. Nice. So NOHARRE Oh, holy shit. That was my Danish shining through. No hair, don't care. Not on the head, but the furry creature, right?
The rabbit like animals.
Yes.
Wonderful. Okay, have you got 15 minutes to just do some Q&A with the patrons?
Definitely.
Perfect. Yeah, so that's another perk for those of you still listening. The on the Patreon, you get to ask the guests the Q&A. So after every episode, we do a Q&A episode, and you can either submit your questions before or watch the show live and ask your questions based on what's been discussed in the episode. And they tend to be a lot of fun. So that's another little perk for just popping over onto Patreon. And it starts from £3 a month. So it's affordable, I think. I think it's affordable. I'm sticking with it. It's affordable. Go and do it. Perfect. Thank you very much. Let's answer some questions.